From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, comedian Jack Gallagher's new play is a memoir of his parents. It's the third in a trilogy of autobiographical one-man plays. What He Left premiered last weekend at Sacramento's B Street Theater. I'll talk with Jack Gallagher about his career in comedy, theater, and TV. Also, goats are the star attraction at a big event at UC Davis tomorrow. I'll talk with one of the organizers of Goat Day 2006. First, the state wants to help improve land use planning in California with the goal of reducing sprawl and gridlock. Today, the Schwarzenegger administration announced big grants to help improve regional planning. The largest of those grants is going to the San Joaquin Valley. Joining me by phone to explain the grant and what it might help achieve is Carol Whiteside, president of the Great Valley Center in Modesto. Carol, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much.
Why is the San Joaquin Valley getting the lion's share of this regional blueprint planning money?
Well, I think several reasons. First of all, I think it's obvious that the San Joaquin Valley is going to be the next huge hotspot for growth in California, from immigration, high birth rates, from people moving from coastal areas. It's going to take the lion's share of growth in the next 20 or 30 years. It's also a region that has not participated a lot. It's been sort of unrecognized, so it's coming to the party.
Could you give us an idea of what kind of growth is expected? Numbers?
The region now from Stockton to Bakersfield is about 3.2 million people. And the projections are that within the next 25 years, it'll go to 5.4. So that's about 2.25 million people in 20 years. That's a lot of change.
And a lot of these people driving on Highway 99, which is already quite congested.
Correct.
So what is this money going to do? Who's going to be spending it on what?
Well, the grant actually went to the Merced Council of Governments on behalf of the 8 councils of governments for the region. Sacramento has one COG called SACOG for all of the counties. We have single county COGs, and so getting them to work together is a huge challenge. The money will be used to support the COGs as they try to coordinate their land use and planning. This is part of a bigger strategy that was started by the governor in July of last year with something called the California Partnership with the San Joaquin Valley. And through the partnership, we're actually looking at very broad strategies for the region. What are we going to do about farmland? How do we reduce the transportation impacts of air quality? Where are the important natural resources? So once that broad cut takes place, then the COGs can take those principles and start applying them county by county and community by community.
But aren't these counties doing land use planning anyway? Why do they need money from the state to help move the process along?
Well, I think because what's been happening in the past is everybody does it locally. And what we're saying now, or what the opportunity from the state is saying, look, it doesn't work anymore just to do it locally. That the reality is that all of these things fit together. There's a lot of integration and coordination that has to take place. There's a lot of data and information that we don't have, and that if this process is going to be successful and not just repeat business as usual, we've got to put more resources on the table.
Is the public going to be asked its opinion?
Absolutely. We're going to have all kinds of outreach. There'll be big public meetings in every county. There will be mailings. There will be websites. We'd like to do the first electronic town hall region-wide if we can work it out.
And when will this regional planning process start in the Valley?
Well, as a matter of fact, right now at the Great Valley Center, there are people in our community room beginning to look at a variety of data and information ways of looking at growth. So what happens if you keep all the growth in existing city limits? What happens if you stay off of all the farmland? What happens if you change the densities? So the conversation is starting almost immediately and will really go on for, I'm sure, more than a year.
Okay. Well, Carol Whiteside, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Carol Whiteside, president of the Great Valley Center. Next, comedian Jack Gallagher and his new play, What He Left. This is Insight. Comedian Jack Gallagher's new play, What He Left, opened last weekend in Sacramento to excellent reviews. It's the third in a trilogy of one-man plays written by and starring Jack Gallagher, all premiered at the B Street Theatre. Jack Gallagher has also worked at the highest levels of stand-up comedy and has hosted many local and national public TV programs. He lives in Sacramento. Right now he's in our studio. Jack Gallagher, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's nice to be here.
I read in the paper that you described your trilogy of plays, which the third being What He Left, as an unintended trilogy.
Right.
Were the plays themselves unintended, or was it the fact that they would culminate in three that was unintended?
The fact that they would culminate in three. The plays were intended. In fact, the first one is called Letters to Declan, which revolves around a series of letters that I wrote to my son that I continue to write to my two sons now that I'll give them when they get to be adults, that they are kept in a drawer at home. The second play was about an experience I had in Hollywood with a sitcom that came out of Letters to Declan. As a result of Letters to Declan, I signed a development deal. And that show kind of juxtaposed the Hollywood experience with a job I had, with all the other jobs I had, basically, specifically a job I had galvanizing nails when I was about 21. And that featured my father in terms of his work ethic and the work ethic I was taught as a kid in New England. And now this show deals with my parents and the house I grew up in. So I wrote all three shows never thinking that they would all tie together. Mm. And certainly not that they would tie together like they do with this last one, which kind of brings it full circle to Letters to Declan.
Could there be a fourth?
No. Not at this point.
Not at this point.
I'm just trying to get this one. I'm relieved that this one is up and running. It took me about 13 months to write it.
Really?
Yeah. So
it's a memoir of your parents, but it's called What He Left. Mm-hmm. Why he and not they?
It's basically about my father. My mother suffered from an illness that kind of put her out of commission a couple of years before she died. So she kind of faded away. My father died very suddenly. And when he died, he left about 9 hours of audio tape talking about his life that my brother had encouraged him to make. But he also left the family house, which this show is about, that he rebuilt a number of times. And so that's what he left as well, in my estimation.
What a thing to have all those hours of audio tape.
Yeah, there's 9 hours, and six of them are you can't listen to them.
Because?
He just babbles on and on and on.
Oh, I see. Did you transcribe the tapes and use them?
I did, and I used them in the show.
Hmm. You have a reading from the from What He Left for us, and I understand this is from the very beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Anything we need to know before you
nope.
say? What do we see on stage?
You see me on stage, and the set is an actual reproduction of the house I grew up in.
Okay.
And there's a couch and a chair and a kitchen table.
Okay.
I heard today that they're thinking of selling Plain Street. That's the house I grew up in, 17 Plain Street in West Bridgewater, Massachusetts. I'd lived in other houses before, but they were never really home. They were just places that we would drive by on a Sunday afternoon, vague memories, curiosities. I grew up at Plain Street. I've never quite understood what it must be like for people who moved around a lot, whose parents were in the military or changed jobs. I can't imagine what it would be like to get used to another place, not having one place to call your base, to call home. Plain Street is home. Now, I can tell you all about the house I live in now, what rooms need to be painted, what walls have cracks, and the windows leak when it rains hard. But Plain Street? I can tell you the really important things about Plain Street. How many steps it takes to get from the porch door to the couch in the den, the best place to hide in the hayloft, the quickest route to the top of the pear tree. I can tell you that there are 12 steps that climb at just over a 45-degree angle to the second floor and that you turn left at the eighth stair. I can tell you that you need to be on the fourth stair on the way down to grab that ledge that's built into the wall and swing yourself to the bottom. I never thought that they would consider selling this place. I thought it would always be in the family. It's as much a part of the family as the people who lived there, and the thought of strangers walking through it, let alone living in it, is almost too much for me to bear.
That's Jack Gallagher with the opening of his new one-man play, What He Left. It opened last weekend at the B Street Theatre, and it runs through early March. How you said it took 13 months to write this.
Yeah.
How did you write it?
Well, when my parents passed away, I got the tapes, and I had the tapes transferred to CD, and then I transcribed them. So I had the tapes. It was a weird thing. My mom died, and when I went back for my mom's service, I knew my father was making these tapes, but he wouldn't tell us what was on them. And I had a very odd discussion with him one day when I was back there for my mom's service, and he and I were alone. And I said, what are you doing with these things? And he said, well, you'll find out when I'm gone. And he said, when I'm gone, do something with them. And I said, what are you talking about? Like what? And he said, do whatever, what you do, write a book, do something with them. So after he passed away and I got them, I was kind of at a loss as to what I was going to do with them. Then I heard from my brother that my sister, who lives in the family house, was thinking of selling it. And that really kind of threw me. So I started to think about the house, him, and I just started to write. I just sat down and started to write. And at first, it's just, for my process for writing is just, I'm a monkey at the keyboard. I type anything that comes into my head. And it just sort of developed out of that.
When your father said, do what you do with it, do you think he was thinking about comedy?
No, because he had seen both Letters to Declan and Just the Guy. And he knew that someone had asked me to write a book about Letters to Declan, publishing the letters, and I wouldn't do that.
Because?
Because they're not for anybody but my kids to read. And so he knew that I wrote. He knew that I'd kind of made the switch from stand-up to television and sort of theater stuff, although I don't consider myself an actor. But so, and it was just this weird kind of conversation that where he said, do something with it. And I had no idea what I could do with it. And I had not heard the tape, so I didn't know anything was on the tape. And like I said, a lot of it, I'm being facetious, a lot of it is, he tells the same story a couple of times in different ways. But there are some real nuggets. I mean, there were some real just amazing things that he said. My father was Irish Catholic, Boston, didn't talk a lot about his feelings, didn't express himself well for a great deal of his life. So to hear him talk about these things on a tape where he was alone in a room by himself and he could say whatever he wanted, knowing that no one was going to hear them until he died, he was very honest about stuff.
You spent many, many years as a stand-up comedian, and I guess a lot of your material for that was created either, in the moment or through improvisation, even if it wasn't at that moment. Did any of those techniques play into writing What He Left or your other plays?
Yes, because they have stand-up pieces in them. They have specific funny 2-3 minute periods or hunks, for lack of that's a comedic term.
Yes.
That I placed in there that I wrote specifically for the play that I worked out in comedy clubs. Because I knew I was going to talk about specific health issues. So I wrote a piece about a kidney stone attack that I had so I could segue into a health thing about my father. So there are specific techniques, comedic techniques that I use that I wrote specifically that I can pull out of there and use in a club act.
Yes.
That are sort of compartmentalized.
The kidney stone hunk, I haven't seen What He Left. Mm-hmm. Is that in the play?
Yes.
I saw that in Conan O'Brien.
Right.
That was
I did
hilarious.
It on Conan. Thank you. Yeah. It wasn't hilarious when it was happening.
I bet.
And at the time it was happening, I wasn't thinking, I've got like 6 good minutes out of this. But it developed that way, so I'm happy.
But isn't that life as a comedian, that some of the most awful and embarrassing things that happen to you become potential material?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing about being a stand-up is that everything that happens, and my wife will sometimes say to me, don't use that. Don't do that. Mm. But everything that happens, especially with the way I write, which is not to, I don't write jokes. I can't write jokes. I just don't know how to do it. So I tell stories in the kind of the tradition of Cosby or George Carlin, Robert Klein. So things that happened to me, after the kidney stone was over, a couple of months afterwards, I thought, boy, that's got to have some funny stuff there. So I write what's around me.
Yes. I would think that most of the material that's in What He Left could have been turned into stand-up material.
Some of it could have, but there's a great deal of serious discussion. My father and I did not have a great relationship when I was younger. Sure. So there's a discussion about that. Some of it could have, but a good deal of it could not have.
Well, how do you shift from thinking as a stand-up and taking an anecdote or a character or something that happened and making it into material for stand-up versus making it material for a play like What He Left?
There's some stuff that can't be made into stand-up. I mean, there's some stuff in this show that just that isn't funny, that's serious and that's truthful and very honest. And so I can't do that. I try to take the audience up and down. I try to laugh and then serious. And I try to do it as abruptly as possible. I try to go from a very high laugh, and then I'll go to a real low point. Mm. I just want to take people from up and down. I want them, when they're done with the evening, to have, I want to be a little tired.
Mm. I was on your website yesterday where there's video,
mm-hmm.
and included on that is your appearance on The Tonight Show with mm-hmm. Johnny Carson, which
right.
was your first appearance
yes.
on national TV. When was that?
1985, so yes. 21 years ago.
Quite some time ago. And it was a great routine. The thing that really struck me was that for me the strongest part was the second half when you're talking about your father and your mother
right.
when you're a child.
Right.
Let's just hear a clip of that.
I think pretty much every father has the same routine when they discipline. Remember when you were kids, you'd be wrestling in your bedroom, your father'd come up into the room, look mad as could be, said to you, "Hey, what is going on up here? What is this, some kind of a playground?" Then they'd always talk to you in staccato like you were stupid. "Now knock! Get off!" Same lines. "You know, I have been up here twice, and if I have to come up here again, you are gonna be sorry." And you'd be thinking, "You know, we weren't real thrilled with this visit." Or he'd come in the room and say, "I am not coming up here again." "Want to sign an affidavit to that effect?"
That's Jack Gallagher on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson over 20 years ago. What did your father make of that kind of use of his persona in your stand-up comedy compared to what he thought you might make of him in a play like What He Left?
He was just thrilled. My father at that point was thrilled that I was making something of myself. I had quit a teaching job to do stand-up full-time. So he was very concerned that, coming from the background that he came from, that I was doing something, my little hobby,
yeah.
instead of having a real job. So he was thrilled when I did The Tonight Show. He thought that was the greatest thing in the world. And if he, I think my father would be thrilled that somebody had written a play about him.
Yes.
To be honest with you, I think that he would enjoy that.
What would your father have liked you to do?
I think my father was very concerned, and I talk about this in the play, my father was very concerned about providing for his family, so much so that we didn't see a lot of him. And I think, I know for a fact that later in his life, he regretted the fact that he didn't spend a lot of time with us, and he focused mainly on the house and making money. At the time I was teaching, he was still in that mindset. There were a couple of things that happened to him personally that changed his opinion about that stuff. But he would have rather that I stayed in a tenured teaching position. I made a solid income. I provided for my kids without the up and down of show business. But once he saw that I was having some success, especially with The Tonight Show, which for a comedian, you know, mm-hmm. it just absolutely solidifies everything. He was very happy that I was doing that. But he would have rather that I had a nice 9-to-5 job.
So it was purely financial and security concerns, not because he thought that there was something, I don't know, sissy about showbiz or anything like that.
Oh, no. No, although he told me a couple of stories about my uncle, who was a comedian for years, my mother's brother. And he told me the story one time about how when my uncle was first starting out, he called my father one night because his car had broken down or something. And when my father went to pick him up, it was in New England, it was in Rhode Island, it was snowing. And my uncle was on the side of the road outside his car wearing his stage clothes, which at the time consisted of this old ratty coat with patches on it and this old beat-up hat. And my father said, "I hadn't ever seen anything so sad or humiliating in my entire life as when I drove up and saw your uncle standing on the side of the road in those ratty clothes." And he's telling me this, like, at some point, that's going to happen to me. I'm in a rite of passage for show business is I'm going to have to stand on the road in the snow in some ratty outfit. So I think that he had maybe a little of that. It wasn't anything about it being a sissy thing. He just thought that I should get a steady job and have something that provided for my family.
Mm. Before we get too far past the clip from the Carson Show, how do you feel today after all these years listening to yourself on your national debut on The Tonight Show?
I'm very funny.
Yeah,
I'm very funny. No,
yeah, it is funny.
It is funny, and it holds up. I mean, I could do that bit now. But I worked really hard to get on The Tonight Show, and it was, like I said, it just in everybody's mind, it cements your reputation. And I was thrilled to be on that show, and I did it a couple times with Johnny, and then I did a few with Jay, and before I stopped kind of concentrating on stand-up. So it was the highlight of my career at that point. I'd only been doing stand-up for about 3 years when I did The Tonight Show.
Wow.
Which is a quick, quick turnaround.
And I think Johnny Carson said you'd been in L.A. for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a big deal, getting on The Tonight Show. How exactly did you get on The Tonight Show?
I auditioned for them 5 times. They turned me down 4 times. And they just, because I tell these big, huge stories. I tell The Tonight Show, you get 6 minutes. I could tell a 6-minute story. The Tonight Show wants you to tell a bunch of jokes. Now, that clip that we played is part of a larger, probably a 3-minute piece of that show. But that whole bit itself is about 7 minutes. So I cut it down. Their theory being 6 minutes. If you do a 6-minute bit and it doesn't get laughs in the first 2 minutes, you're stuck with 4 more minutes of a bit that's not going to get laughs.
Yeah.
If you do a 30-second joke, a 45-second joke, and it doesn't work, let's go on to the next one. So I started auditioning for them doing what I did, big pieces of material. And they said, no, this isn't what we want. So I started to kind of focus myself on getting on that show, cutting my material down. And it took me 5 auditions to finally get on the show. They kept saying to me, it's just not going to work. But I wanted it so badly that I just focused all my energy on getting on The Tonight Show. And it happened eventually.
Do you remember what it was like standing on the other side of those silver curtains?
Yes.
Waiting to step out? What was it like?
Not only that, I wasn't nervous. I was so ready to go that I just wanted to go. And when I heard my name, his voice muffled through those heavy drapes, the stagehands opened the curtain, and I was just ready to go. The fear came when I finished. Because I had been gearing for this since the first time I got on stage. Every comic wanted to do this Tonight Show. So I just been gearing for this moment for, 3 years at this point, which now seems like no time at all. But when I was done, it's such a tiny space on that stage. Doc Severinsen was close enough to you that you could literally, if he stuck his arm out and I stuck my arm out, we could touch each other. And Carson's not that far away. And as soon as I got done, I started thinking, did I do a good job? Did I do all the material I wanted to? And then I started to get really nervous.
It's a funny routine, but I noticed that your first joke didn't get much of a laugh.
Well, an interesting thing. I wanted to open up with another joke. And the talent coordinator at the time, see, now this is a great point. The talent coordinator at the time said, save that joke. Give me like a C joke instead of an A or a B joke. Give me a joke that's okay, but not great.
Why?
Because, he said, nobody knows who you are. And when you walk out from behind that curtain, for the first 30 seconds, they're thinking, okay, this guy's tall, he's thin, oh, he's got some gray hair, young guy with gray hair. You open your mouth and they're going to say, he's got a bit of an accent, he's from Boston. So they're not listening to the joke. They're looking at you and they're sizing you up. And for that first 30 seconds, they're just kind of getting a scope as to who you are. And then they're going to start listening after the first joke. So give me a joke that isn't great, that'll get a little chuckle, and then we'll get to the meat of the matter with the second joke.
Oh, my goodness. And I guess they knew what they were talking about. Did you agree with them before?
Absolutely.
And after?
I wanted to get on the show. I was going to do whatever they told me to do.
No.
I mean, they went through that 6-minute set word for word. What word are you going to use at the end of this joke? And what's the first word of the beginning of the second joke? Mm. I don't like that word. Let's change it. And let's find another segue to get from that. I mean, that bit was gone over so many times with a fine. I knew every single word I was going to say. I knew how many breaths I was going to take between setups and punches. I mean, it was so clinical that it could have very easily taken the heart out of it if I didn't know what I was doing.
Because I was really impressed with the way that you walk through the curtains. You tell your first joke, hardly anyone laughs, and you didn't miss a beat. You just looked just the same, and you moved on. But now I know why.
And I've been working on that bit for months, that 6 minutes. I remember the week before I was at Caesars in Tahoe doing a week at the casino, and I came out every single night. I would do a 45-minute set. Every night I would do that 6 minutes first, cold. I want to do it with no – I want to do it as cold as that audience is. And then the other 39 minutes was like an afterthought, because it was like, I want you people to like me, but I'm doing The Tonight Show next week, and this 6 minutes has to work. So it was just, I knew exactly what I was doing.
What would you do in other cases where people weren't laughing and they were supposed to?
Well, it depends on what point you are in your career. I mean, there aren't a lot of times now that people don't laugh. I mean, that sounds terrible, but I know how to do it.
Yeah.
And if you put me in front of a room of people who speak English, I'll make them laugh. I just know how to do it. If it isn't working, I'll go to something else. I'll go to something that I know works. I mean, you know, there's stuff that's tried and true. There's new stuff. There's old stuff that works.
Because Jay Leno and David Letterman get bailed out by their band, because when the joke falls flat, the band just quickly kicks in with a bit of music. But when you're the stand up on stage with nothing, you don't have anything to play with. So,
but that's the beauty of that and art, is that that not just me, but anybody who just stands up there with a microphone has nothing but their wits. That's all you have. You can't, if the joke fails, you can't start to play the guitar or you can't play your organ. You just have to find a way to get around it. And if you're headlining and you're up there for 45 minutes, that means you've followed 45 minutes before you of people. So you have to deliver the goods. And it's just, I mean, it's a very stressful situation sometimes, but if you're good at it, you know what you're doing. It's like anything else. It's like, you know, I can't compare it to being a doctor or anything like that, but I mean, I just know what I'm doing. It's my occupation. It's what I do. So,
this is Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, more from Jack Gallagher. We'll be right back. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. My guest is comedian Jack Gallagher.
I get older. I don't know what it is. I don't have the drive I used to have. I don't. You know, the big thing in this country, you got to be number one, man. Everybody's got to be number one. Woo! Number one. We're number one. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's just gotten to a point where it's ridiculous now. You watch a football game, there's always the camera on some big fat guy in the stands drinking a beer, sticking his finger in the camera. We're number one! Well, you're a little confused. See, they're number one, you're fat and drunk. Do you see the difference at all?
That's a character that looks and sounds a lot like Jack Gallagher on the animated series Dr. Katz. A lot of comedians worked in that show.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with that? Were you given a script or were you asked to come up with something for it?
No, they just asked me. Jonathan's a friend of mine, Jonathan Katz, who played Dr. Katz. I was actually in a studio here in Sacramento and he was on a line in New York. And he just said, let's run through about 15 minutes of your material. So I did a bit about that. And then I did a bit, I think, about my wife having a baby, having our first baby.
Yes.
And then they just picked what they wanted, I guess, 6 or 7 minutes and animated it.
And they created an animated character that looks a lot like you.
Right, which is kind of interesting because they sent one of the animated cells to my house afterwards, and my son, Declan, who at the time was probably 3, got all upset. He said, you're not a cartoon. You're my dad. So, but that was a fun show to do. That was always a really funny show, I thought.
Mm. You said before our break that that stand-up is quite stressful. Is that why you, well, I don't want to say gave it up, because You did stand up on Conan O'Brien just last year.
Yeah, here's an interesting thing. They called me about 2 weeks ago and asked me to do another one. They said, when do you want to come back? And I said, I'm in the middle of this play that I just wrote, so I can't come until March at least. So I'm planning on doing another one in March or April. I just decided that I spent 15 years on the road. I spent 15 years. At the beginning, I was doing 40, 42 weeks a year on the road before we had kids. And then when the kids came, I dialed it back to the end. I was doing about 15 weeks. And I just got tired of it. I just got tired of being in hotels and airports. And I went to Milwaukee the day before yesterday for one night, for a one-nighter. And so I flew to Milwaukee on Wednesday. I did the gig Wednesday night, and I flew home yesterday. And I said to my wife, I hate this. I can't believe I did this every other week for all those years. And so I just got tired of the life on the road. And I moved up here, and we decided to start a family, and I just decided to start looking around here. I wanted to be around the kids, and I wanted to not be on the road so much. So it was just, I mean, I still love doing it, but I don't love it enough that I'm willing to travel anymore.
Mm, but you are still doing some.
Yeah, I do it. I do as much as I can, and I love working in clubs because I can talk about whatever I want to talk about. I do a lot of corporate gigs like this thing in Milwaukee, but those have to be relatively clean, and not that I work blue, but you can't do a lot of religious stuff or political stuff. Not that I do a lot of that, but in the clubs, I'm free to talk about whatever I want to talk about.
Yeah, but the kidney stone and the the testicle story don't make it into the corporate gigs, I guess.
You know, that's funny because I did that on Conan, and I kept saying to them, I can refer to this, and I can touch this. And they said, yeah. So then I go to do this corporate gig in Milwaukee, and I do the testicle thing, but I have to clean it way up, which is interesting because I'm doing it live, and on television I can do it much broader. Yes. So,
how did you come to move to Sacramento? Because you was that coming from Los Angeles?
Yeah, I moved from Boston to Los Angeles, and I was doing auditions for sitcoms and the typical thing. And I got an audition up here with Channel 3 to host a television show, and they hired me to do that just out of the blue. I mean, I literally moved up here January 7th, and a week later I was hosting a live one-hour television show that didn't last very long.
And what kind of show was it?
Excuse me, it was a mess. It was called a mess. No, it was the way I described it to people was like the center point of a triangle that was the Today Show, David Letterman, and Phil Donahue.
And was this purely for local broadcast?
Yes. They wanted to syndicate it, but they didn't know what they wanted. So as a result, they didn't hire any writers. They hired me, but they didn't want me to be funny. It was a weird, you know, and in no way did The Daily Show take anything from us, but it was very similar to The Daily Show. We did fake news.
Yeah.
We had a guest. We would do field pieces. We would send a reporter to the governor's press conference, and they would ask, while everyone was asking about the land use grants, our reporter would ask what kind of refreshments they were going to serve after the press conference. It was just goofy stuff like that. You know, on one day we had a big parade outside the fountain at Channel 3. It was National Beef Month, Scout Month, and Dental Health Month. And we had a cow with the sides of beef painted on it and Cub Scouts marching with dental floss. And Channel 3 didn't, John Kelly, who owned Channel 3 at that point, I don't think quite knew what to make of it.
You said they didn't want you to be funny, but you said it was also kind of like The Daily Show.
Yeah, but they didn't know what they wanted. Nobody had seen The Daily Show at that point. They hired a comedian. This is their mantra, was fun, not funny. And I was having a hard time finding the difference between the two because I'd come from the world of stand-up, and the only television I'd done was 6 minutes. I'd done Merv Griffin. I had done Johnny Carson. I'd done a couple of cable things. So hosting a one-hour television show, I was like, talk about a fish out of water. But then my wife and I decided we didn't want to go back to L.A. We wanted to start a family, and we didn't want to raise kids in Los Angeles. So we just decided to stay here.
You've done a lot of public TV.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into that?
Again, it was somebody saw me doing stand-up. I used to represent a dairy locally. I did a bunch of commercials for a number of years for Crystal Dairy. And somebody asked me if I wanted to host this television show. Would I want to try it? And I said, yeah. And it was what they wanted. It was a money show. And the initial one was a money show.
Is this Money Moves?
Yes. Yeah. And I would just I was just the host. I know nothing about money other than I can balance my checkbook pretty well. But I would just toss it to packages. Here's Jeffrey Callison with a piece about cell phones. And I would just do ad-lib stuff. We would go to different places, and I would ad-lib introductions to pieces.
And it seemed that, this is KVIE producing.
Yes.
It seemed like they actually did want you to be funny rather than just fun.
Yes, absolutely. I could do whatever I wanted to do on that show, and it was great. And we were in, I believe, when they canceled the show, I believe we were in 70... on 70 stations around the country.
Hmm.
Now, I just recently hosted another one that we're waiting to see if we get picked up for a second season called Money Track. That was the presenting station is in Philadelphia, and we're on 125 stations around the country. So I co-host that with a woman. I'm less funny on that show, but Money Moves was great because we would literally go to a flea market, and I would just walk around and pick stuff up and talk and toss it to a package. I would try to tie it in. So I started that way, and then since then I've had a good deal of success with KVIE in terms of hosting different shows for them, more serious stuff and comedic stuff.
Could you have imagined 20 years ago that you'd be hosting a PBS show about money?
I couldn't have found Sacramento in Northern California if you spotted me Northern California 20 years ago. No, I never thought I would be on television. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was teaching. I didn't have a plan. I was going to do stand-up, then I was going to go back to teaching.
Another TV show that you're on is Curb Your Enthusiasm, mm-hmm. with Larry David.
Right.
And we have a clip from that. This is where you play, you've played a few times, Larry David's
doctor. Yeah, I play his
doctor.
Right.
And here we are sitting in a treatment room, and Larry David has a fractured finger.
Right.
Let's hear it.
So what are we going to do? What are you going to do?
Well, I can't do anything right now. I can't do anything, Larry, until you pay my wife's fee and my fee in advance. That's the way we're going to do this.
Let me tell you something, okay? John, I didn't ask her to read that script.
She read the script,
she
Larry.
She didn't have to read that
she
script.
She did read
but
it, though.
But who told her to read it? I didn't
she read it
read
as
it.
A professional courtesy to
doesn't
you, as a
matter.
Friend of yours.
Courtesy.
She
that's
read
a courtesy.
It.
That's some
it
courtesy.
Was. She
I'd
took
like
some...
to get courtesy like that from everybody. She Boy, took... I'll be
you
the
would,
poor
you
house.
Would be lucky if you did.
That's
she,
quite a courtesy.
She took the time from her day, and let me tell
what
you something.
Time?
She made some significant notes on that script.
Who gives a shit about her notes? I didn't ask her to read that script. I don't want her notes. I don't care about her notes. I don't need her notes.
How about the finger? How about that? Do you care about that?
Yes, I do.
Well, here's what's going to happen with that, pal of mine. Her money up front, my money right now, and then we take a look at the finger. How do you feel about that? Because that's the game we're playing now. What do you need a couple of minutes? Because I got some patients I could look out there. You know what? This is embarrassing.
Yeah, you should be embarrassed.
Not embarrassed for me. All right, give me a couple of minutes. I'll be right back and we'll fix it. Hey, you're going to get Miles.
And that's Jack Gallagher getting Larry David's credit card. On Curb Your Enthusiasm, it has an improvised feel to it.
It's improvised.
Yeah.
They give you a scrap of paper, a little two-sentence description of what the scene is, and three or four of the facts that need to be explained during the scene, and then you just go.
Mm.
So I was told for that was the first season, that was the first show I did, I was told, Larry's injured a finger in a fight. Your wife, Red, is his lawyer, and she read a spec script of his that she charged him for, and he doesn't want to pay. So now you don't want to fix his finger until he pays you. And then we just go.
For someone who says he isn't an actor, you look pretty good as an actor to me on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Is that something you would like to do more of?
I like doing that show. I like doing that show more than other acting shows that I've done. And I'm just not a classically trained actor. I'm very comfortable doing comedic stuff. I'm comfortable playing somebody that's close to me. I'm not going to play, you know, I'm not De Niro. But I don't turn anything down. I enjoy that show very much. And I've been lucky to do, I think, 4 out of the 5 seasons for them.
And returning to your play, mm-hmm. What He Left, how did you shape, without a theater background, a formal theater background, how did you shape this memoir of your parents into something dramatic?
Because of Letters to Declan and Just the Guy, I now have more of an inkling as to how to do that, and I know how to write dramatic stuff, and I know how to be truthful on stage. And that's all this is. I'm just telling stories about my childhood, and I'm telling them in a truthful way, and I'm talking about relationships between my family members in a truthful way. So it the most difficult part was finding a way to make it seamless, and that Buck Busfield, who directed it, did that. I mean, he's just invaluable in terms of saying, okay, well, I mean, he would say to me, don't do this. This gives too much away. Do this. Let's move in this direction. He's very kind of, he's got this aura that about him that I feel totally comfortable with him. I trust him so much. But he'll say to me, between pages 35 and 50, there's something missing. And I'll say, what? Just take a look and look at tone. And so then I'll go back for those 15 pages and I'll think, where's the tone? But I'll find it. I'll go back and say, oh, great wise Buck, is this what you were talking about? He'll go, yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about. So let's move that. So I go in there with 120 pages of this ball of words. And then a month later, after all these rehearsals, we're down to about 90 minutes of thinking about a page a minute. So we're down to about 90 minutes of something that has a thread that goes up and down, that moves along. And well, most of the time I'll say, yeah, I agree with that. Sometimes I'll say, no, I want to leave that in, or I want to do that just like that. But I feel more comfortable. I have a really specific writing process that I go through that involves all these index cards and color codes and a big board that I put things on and move it around. And I have a whole process that I go through where I can actually look at a big board with 4x6 index cards on it that are color-coded.
With scenes or hunks on them?
Scenes, hunks, laughs, props, dramatic moments, and I'll draw almost a schematic of the... I mean, I'm very... I do it in a very orderly, linear way. I have a schematic... First thing I do is draw a graph of the show, where I want it to go up and down, where it's going to bottom out, and then I build my cards, then I start to write.
When you say up or down, do you mean the emotional content?
Mm-hmm. Where laughs are going to go, where serious stuff is going to go. I don't want to bottom out too much. I don't want people to go, oh, my God, I can't believe he's talking about this, without giving them some relief. And so even in those moments that are really dramatic and really personal and really that are very real moments, I try to get a little bit of a laugh in there so that people aren't going, I can't believe he's talking about this, and we're going to have to listen to him.
Has your graph of plays changed as you've now moved into your third?
A little bit. I'm more comfortable doing it. When I wrote Letters to Declan, I had no idea what I was doing. I'd never done anything other than stand-up, and I was used to trying to get a laugh every 15 to 30 seconds. So it was very difficult to go 2 or 3 minutes without a laugh, but I've become more comfortable with that, and as a result, I think I've learned how to write that stuff better.
Mm. Woody Left runs through March 5th. What are your plans after that?
I'm going to take a rest.
Yeah.
This has been quite a... I'll go back to doing what I do. You know, I do... Hopefully, I'll be working on the television show again. I'm the spokesperson for a couple of businesses here in Northern California. I'll do corporate stuff. I keep turning over rocks.
Any other plans for plays, either one-man shows or even something bigger than that?
Not at this point. I literally put the index cards away last week that have been sitting on a board in my office for the last 13 months. So I'm not going to think about writing for a while.
Yes. Well, Jack Gallagher, it was a real pleasure meeting you, and all the best with what he left.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it too.
Good. This is Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, goats are the star attraction at a big UC Davis event tomorrow. I'll talk with one of the organizers of Goat Day 2006. We'll be right back. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You'll find more information on our program on our website, capradio.org/insight. Goats are the star attraction at a big event at UC Davis tomorrow. It's Goat Day 2006. Talk topics include goat DNA testing, milking procedures, the outlook for a small farm meat goat industry in California, and more. Joining me by phone is one of the organizers of Goat Day 2006, Dr. Joan Dean Rao, an associate professor in the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Rao, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Why a day devoted to goats at UC Davis?
Well, actually, this event has taken place for more than 25 years as an annual event, and the day is a day to extend knowledge to producers, both from youth goat owners up to commercial cheese producers and meat goat producers, to bring people together and give them the latest in goat research and to also extend some knowledge about basic care procedures and maintaining healthy goats.
Hmm. Is the goat a relative of the sheep?
In a sense that they're both ruminant species, but goats are separate and distinct, and they're used for everything from commercial meat production and milk production to being kept as companions or as packing animals, and so they're an animal with many functions.
Kept as companions. Are many goats kept as pets?
There are small breeds of goats, for example, the pygmy or the Nigerian dwarf goat, that are kept often as companion animals and often in urban environments. And the goats are very social and interactive animals, so even in the commercial setting, we find them quite interactive and quite enjoyable to maintain.
Well, that makes them quite different from sheep. Couldn't imagine a sheep as a pet. So they're intelligent, sociable creatures.
Yes.
How do we know that they're intelligent? What kind of things do they do? What is typical behavior for a goat that makes someone that knows goats go, you know, smile?
Well, if you come on out to Goat Day, there actually will be some animals on display that will be used in the displays. But some typical things where they might differ from cattle behavior or from sheep behavior are their inquisitive nature and their interest in even animals that are, again, raised in a large herd setting will still, follow you around and tend to show a lot of individual behaviors and interact with the people that are with them.
Hmm. They seem to have a relatively low profile, despite the fact that they're well-known animals. Why are they lower profile? Why are they less well-known, do you think, than cows and sheep and pigs and other farm animals?
I think if we look worldwide at animal husbandry and the association of animals with man, the goats enjoy a long time of high profile in their various agricultural settings. The goat in California or the goat in the United States, while there's been a small but healthy goat cheese production, milk production, and meat production, especially with the increase in people of other from other countries having a demand for consumption of goat meat, and in general with its healthful products, the increase in demand for goat milk and goat cheese, their profile is certainly increasing.
Mm. Do you enjoy eating goat meat or the milk or cheese that come from goats?
Yes, actually, I have goats myself, and so we consume milk in our home. And then in my work with the School of Veterinary Medicine, we attend to the health of meat and milk goat herds. And so the cheeses that are available and then the meat products that come from them, although they do differ slightly in their taste, are unique. And so they're a unique product. Again, if you haven't tried goat cheese, it's delicious.
I encourage you to try it.
Mm.
Still, you talked about goats being making good pets, being intelligent, lively creatures. I think for at least some people, it's easier to think about eating the meat of a sheep or a cow because they seem so they don't seem as intelligent as, say, dogs and cats, the kind of animals that we typically bond with. It sounds like you're saying that goats are animals that we could bond with. You presumably are one of those people. You're fond of goats. Isn't it hard to get around that when eating goat meat or their milk?
Well, I think that's a more basic question of responsible stewardship of food animals. For example, I love and work with sheep and cattle and goats alike. And so certainly we want to keep a healthy population and enjoy interacting with them during the time that they're in service or in production. But in terms of meat consumption, again, one would feel the same way, I think, about cattle and sheep as well.
Mm. My guest is Dr. Joan Dean Rao. She's an associate professor at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine and one of the organizers of Goat Day 2006. Tomorrow, if you'd like more information on Goat Day 2006, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. There is a link to Goat Day 2006. Who's welcome at Goat Day?
As I said before, the day is really designed to reach a wide audience. And in fact, its former name was Dairy Goat Day, but with the increase in meat goat rearing, both in terms of youth projects and as a commercial venture, many meat goat topics have been added, and so the day is really intended for people who are both interested in proper goat husbandry and learning about goat research that's going on here, either in the School of Veterinary Medicine or the Department of Animal Science. And so our typical attendees range from youth of 4-H and FFA club members to commercial producers, but any interested member of the public who'd like to come and learn a little bit about goat husbandry is welcome to attend.
Mm. You're giving a presentation, I notice on the brochure, called What Goat Owners Need to Know About Club Lamb Fungus. Is that an academic presentation, or is it meant for just interested people?
This one actually would be intended especially for the younger audience, the 4-H club and FFA chapter members who exhibit their market goat projects or their breeding goat projects at the fairs, in that there is a skin disease that we see commonly in lambs that we are starting to see more as our goats being at potential risk of as these animals are commingled. It's one of the sort of childhood or juvenile diseases of the skin.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Rao, thank you so much for joining us today and letting us know a bit about goats and Goat Day 2006.
Well, we certainly welcome everyone to come. Registration begins at 8:15 at Freeborn Hall at the UC Davis campus.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Joan Dean Rao, Associate Professor at UC Davis. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, tour of the recording studio that immortalized Buena Vista Social Club. That story from Havana and the news next on The World. The Insight theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley, who's also Insight's music editor. Today's engineer was John Florek. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us. Jeffrey Callison. On the next Insight, the Children of Uganda, an ensemble of musicians, singers, and dancers, perform traditional music of Uganda live in our studio. I'll also speak with local best-selling novelist John Lesqua about his latest suspense book. It's the start of a new series with a new protagonist. Join me for Insight.
Monday afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.